From KLCC Studios, this is Oregon on the Record.
I'm Michael Dunn. We're all aware, especially with the war in Iran, how vulnerable we all are to disruptions in the global oil supply. Well, there's another commodity of global importance that is facing the potential of a major disruption, but this commodity doesn't flow through oil wells, it walks on four legs. Recently, an outbreak of a parasite called the New World Screwworm is generating alarm in the massive beef industry. Today on the show, you'll hear from Oregon's chief veterinarian about this parasite and what the state is doing to keep it from entering our herds. The U.S. had eradicated this pest back in the 1960s, but today it's back. Then, at the end of the show, you'll hear from our reporter about the important work being done to restore and retain the Mackenzie River floodplain. That's next on Oregon on the Record. Whether you're a voracious carnivore or a dedicated vegan, you're still impacted by the national and state cattle industry given its impact on so many aspects of our society. Today on the show, you'll hear from the person in charge of keeping Oregon cattle free of a re-emerging parasite that, left unchecked, could wreak havoc on cows from every corner of our state. Dr. Ryan Scholes, the state of Oregon state veterinarian, thanks so much for coming on and talking with us.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Let's start with this. Describe what New World Screwworm is and what does it do?
Yeah, so New World Screwworm is a parasite that infects livestock or really any warm-blooded animals. So in its most basic sense, it's a larvae of a fly. It's, you know, commonly called a maggot. But it's a fairly unique fly. It's native to South America. It was once present in the U.S. We eradicated it as a country back in the late 1960s. And then over the next 20, 30 years, progressively pushed it down south through Mexico, through South America, and back down into South America. There was a control program established in Panama. Since then, we've been free of it. Now it's making its way back. And so the unique thing about this particular maggot or the screwworms is that instead of consuming dead tissue, which is what most like bot flies and maggots that we have here native in the U.S., it consumes live tissue. So the flies lay their eggs on the edge of wounds, and then those larvae essentially burrow into the tissue and can cause really fast tissue destruction, can create very large wounds very quickly.
Okay, and then if the host is infected with this parasite, does it kill them?
It can. If not treated, it can. The thing with this is it is still a parasite. It is treatable. It's not a virus. You know, it's fairly easily treatable if caught early on. And so that's one of the reasons why we're really trying to get the word out, is just so everyone's kind of on the lookout, has it in the back of their mind that if they see this, you know, say something, so we can get it diagnosed, get treatment initiated, and save that animal and prevent further reinfestation of additional animals, because the last thing we want is for those larvae to continue their life cycle, drop off of that animal pupate, create more flies that then create more infestation.
So if what would be the symptoms? How would someone know if a livestock they have has it?
Yeah, oftentimes it's wounds that progress really fast. It's an animal that looks off, that, you know, fairly rapidly is declining. Oftentimes these wounds progress in a matter of like 3 to 5, maybe 7 days. They're very quick. They'll develop a strong odor. They'll be very large. The animal just looks like they're in a lot of pain. A lot of what we're seeing out of Texas and previously we're seeing in Mexico, the most common lesions were umbilical lesions. So it's in newborn calves or other livestock species. They get into the umbilical cord. And so it's a calf that's looking really, really like it's doing really poor, like its abdomen's really swollen. That smell is something that in veterinary medicine we always go off of. You can often smell something's wrong before you can see it. And that's kind of the case with a lot of these too.
How quickly can it spread throughout a herd?
So it depends. Right now it is confined pretty much just to an area of South Texas, and then there's been one case in New Mexico, right on the Texas-New Mexico border. So even just within an area, in those cases, I think every one of those cases. I think there's 12 cases at this point, as of when we're talking. It has been a single animal in a herd. So if you catch it quickly, you can stop it in that animal because it's not a disease. It's a parasite. It has to complete its life cycle. Hmm. And that life cycle is anywhere, depending on climate, anywhere from about 18 to 21 days between when a fly lays an egg to where those eggs have matured into adults that can then lay eggs. So if you get one infested animal, as long as we can catch it quickly, we can stop it there.
Okay.
If we don't catch it, that's where it can perpetuate and it can become a much bigger problem. And that's what a lot of this response is about. It's here, it's in Texas, we know it's there, but stopping those infestations quickly so that they're not multiplying and spreading further.
Okay. You mentioned that it can impact other warm-blooded animals. I guess maybe a simple question is, could humans be impacted by this?
They can, and they have. We actually, the first case in this outbreak, well, kind of associated with this in the U.S. was actually a human several months ago. Hmm. They were not infested in the U.S. They came from a country where this is endemic with an infestation. But yes, they can. The major difference is people tend to notice things crawling around in their cuts.
Sure.
Faster than you may notice something crawling around in the cut of a cow that's out roaming on a couple hundred acres. And so that's the big thing. Most of the times when people get infested, it's a pretty quick, they notice it really quickly, they can get treatment really quickly, and we can take care of it right away. Whereas animals, oftentimes, it may get missed in the early stages.
I see. Could it also spread to native populations like deer and elk?
Okay. Yeah, and that's they haven't found it in any deer or elk right now in Texas, but that's in Mexico and in South America, it's very common in wildlife. Hmm. And part of the theory of why we're seeing it as kind of as spread out as we are right now is that it likely is affecting some wildlife species of some sort down there.
I see.
And that's probably how it's spreading right now.
I see. If you're just joining us, we're talking to Dr. Ryan Scholes. He's the state veterinarian here in Oregon, talking about the New World screwworm. How do you stop it? How do you stop the spread? What are kind of the steps that are necessary?
Yeah, so the biggest thing and the way that we as a country eradicated it back in the 60s was through what's called sterile fly technique. Essentially, most flies, this one particularly, only mate once in their life cycle. And so the idea is if you can flood the area with sterile males, when those wild females mate, the overwhelming likelihood is they'll mate with a sterile male. That's their one-time mating, and then they lay eggs that are sterile and don't hatch. And so it's kind of a long-term control. That's what USDA is doing a lot of right now down in Texas. They're releasing a lot of sterile flies. They've been doing that. You may have heard of some of the news articles. There's a facility they're building or converting in Matapa, Mexico. More Air Force Base in Texas is being converted and has a facility there for sterile fly production being built so that they can produce the number of sterile flies they need to really control this outbreak. Beyond that, at a more localized scale, it's more control rather than eradication. Really, the only way you're going to get rid of it is through the sterile flies. But we can control it until we get to that point. And so that's really where we're at right now. A lot of that focuses around from individual owners. It's surveillance. It's keeping an eye on your animals. It's if you notice something's off, contacting your veterinarian, getting them out to examine, taking a look. If something seems sketchy, letting us know, letting your veterinarian know, so we can get it investigated, get it treated if needed.
Okay.
And then kind of at a more macro local scale, if we have a case here in Oregon, we have a state response plan that would involve a whole bunch of state and federal agencies kind of treating the animals on that farm. This is an infestation, it's not a disease, so we can easily treat for it. We want to treat for it. And then doing some movement restrictions around that area and doing some surveillance in that area to ensure we don't have more cases in the area. And then controlling any additional cases we find.
Okay. As best you can you describe, you said that we had eradicated it back in the 60s in this country. Any guesses as to how it came back?
Yeah, so this is something we've been watching and kind of preparing for a number of years. The control program that was established after it was eradicated and pushed down through Panama was over the Darien Gap in Panama, narrowest part of that, the Panamanian Isthmus. They consistently release sterile flies. there. There were, the theory is probably some illegal livestock movements through that area that happened, and that breached that control area. That control area was really established for controlling natural encroachment of the fly. There are checkpoints or some other things that the U.S. and the Panamanian governments collaborate on, but they're not perfect. And then as it got past that, then it gets into larger areas. And it's been just kind of slowly encroaching north through natural encroachment, through movement of livestock. And frankly, we've been expecting this for a while. I think a lot of us expected we'd probably see it in the U.S. before we did. Which means that we've had a little bit longer to prepare. And so a lot of those response plans at the state and federal level have had a little more time to mature. And we have a lot of those resources available at this point.
Okay.
Or, for the sterile flies, we have those in process and well underway.
I see. Any impact to the food system? I mean, I know it's, like you said, it's very small in Texas right now, but you don't think so?
No, and it's an external parasite. It's something we can treat for easily. It's not a food issue. It does not affect food. It really, the food is still safe. Even an affected animal, after you treat it and you go through withdrawal periods, that infested animal can still be used for food production even. So.
Okay. Obviously, there have been reports about funding cuts throughout the federal government, and I'm wondering if the agricultural department was impacted. And does that raise, for someone such as yourself at the state level, do you have concerns about funding to help eradicate this challenge?
So I think funding is always going to be a big component of any disease response we have. Whether the funding levels at the federal government, there's actually been a lot of funding that has been dedicated to this response specifically. So this response has kind of happened outside of some of the other political stuff that's happened at the federal government. I don't know that I'm involved enough in that to really speak a whole lot to it. But what I can say is that there really resources really have been poured into this disease response at a federal level. And there's been a lot of work that's been done, a lot of people dedicated to it, a lot of funding that has gone to it. So I don't think so.
Okay.
I don't think that's been a significant impact.
Okay. As the climate has changed and gotten warmer, are conditions now better for the screwworm? I think you mentioned that it sort of began in South America. As our climate's gotten warmer, does that mean our climate here in Oregon is more conducive than it might have been 50, 100 years ago?
Maybe.
Okay.
At a small scale. So it's a tropical fly. Where it in its home range, it's in the tropical areas. So if you look at a lot of the eradication maps that kind of talk about when we historically eradicated this, the northern half of the U.S. was never really listed because we eradicated it every winter. As soon as you get a hard freeze, this is a tropical fly. It doesn't survive hard freezes.
I see.
I don't think it significantly impacts. This New World screwworm did potentially exist. There were cases of it that would happen in the northern climates in Oregon. But we didn't have sustained populations because we get hard winters. I think on a grand scale, on a national scale, that line of where we would eradicate it every year then and where we do now, sure, maybe that's shifted north, right? We saw USDA update some of the plant climate zones here in the last couple of years to kind of reflect that. So maybe, I think in individual years, we have winters that are maybe colder or warmer than historically we have had, and that certainly could impact on a short term whether we get rid of, any infestations that we have in a given year, right? If this had happened a year ago here in the Willamette Valley in Oregon, I mean, we probably wouldn't, it didn't get all that cold this winter. And so we may have seen a few more cases surviving the winter than we would have normally. But I don't think on a grand scale we can really say, we're going to have this absolutely now because it's a few degrees warmer than it was 50 years ago when we didn't ever. It can survive during this time of the year.
Okay.
Pretty much anywhere if it's transported there.
Okay. Doctor, my last question for you is, what will the signals from Texas mean to you that perhaps the challenge has passed? Will it be kind of that they'll find no more cases? That's the hope? Or is this kind of, just an ongoing observation, no matter what, to make our, you know, cattle herds safe?
Yeah, so unfortunately, you know, Texas is kind of the tip of the iceberg right now in terms of when you look at Texas and then you look south from Texas. And so, you know, this has been slowly encroaching through Mexico. And so, you know, even if Texas can eradicate it right now, can flood the air with sterile flies, and we don't see more cases in Mexico, we still have cases happening just south in Mexico. And so, you know, we're going to continue seeing those encroachments. It's really going to be that concerted effort by states, by the federal government, by the federal Mexican government, by Mexican state governments, to really work together like we saw back in the late 20th century to push this worm fly back down past the Darien Gap. This is something we're going to be dealing with at least in the backs of our minds for quite some time, I think, until we can get enough sterile flies produced and enough releases to be able to really push it back down south. So I think it's something we're going to be dealing with for a while. Whether that is, you know, by seeing expanding cases here in the U.S., or they can hold it to just Texas and we see occasional encroachments, you know, I don't know. But that's I think, really what we're kind of looking at, is this is going to be a long-term kind of slow simmering response at a minimum.
He's Dr. Ryan Scholes, the state veterinarian for us here in Oregon. Doctor, really appreciate you coming on and talking about this important issue.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Now let's check in with our reporter about the Mackenzie River floodplain. Karen Richards, a reporter for us here at KLCC. Karen, great to see you. Thanks so much for coming in.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I really enjoyed your story about the Mackenzie River floodplain. You know, what'd you learn? Talk about it.
What I thought was interesting, a couple of things. I had only started hearing about it after the Holiday Farm fire because I know that, you know, after all that area was just burned and devastated, you would see the big machinery off to the side and heard the first stories about what they were trying to do there. But this has been in progress since well before that.
Oh, okay.
And in fact, they learned things from the fire that they hadn't anticipated, so that some of the projects they'd already been working on widening the river and making more of a wetland area, that actually was a break for some of those fires that they helped in ways that they hadn't anticipated.
Okay.
So that was one thing I learned.
Yeah. I mean, basically, if you could, for folks, explain why they're doing what they're doing.
Yeah, absolutely. So it all started with a paper, and I'm going to forget the year that came out. But they, this is all new territory. But they had learned that there was a theory out there that if you made rivers back to what they were before, people narrowed them for industry, but also just to put roads in next to a river. You don't want it making its own course every once in a while and covering a road. So people made these rivers that were very deep and narrow, but that's not the way the rivers want to be. And so if we can widen out some of the channels that feed into the Mackenzie will stay as it is. But some of these rivers that come in, make them wider, make them chart their own course when there's a storm, when there's a, you know, an event, that it is more healthy for everything, from the water quality to be able to filter through that silt now, for the fish who can now have places to hide and not be in this deep torrent of water that's just fast and deep. So it's... you know, it's been ongoing. They've done several locations. I was able to see several in different stages of construction, which was fascinating, and it seems to be working.
Yeah. Basically, I know you're not a construction expert, but how are they doing it? You talk about this massive machinery that's out there. Kind of, is it just moving a lot of earth and restoring a path for the water?
Right, what they call cut and fill. So they cut out some of the dirt, fill it into other places to make this new level of where the water is going to find its way around. They've left some trees that were standing. The fire did go through there, so they had to take out a lot of trees. There was a campground there that the Forest Service decided was not worth opening again. So they're using that whole area, making it into this basin. And yes, it's a lot of heavy equipment, which a lot of people question. You know, is that environmentally unfriendly? but the theory is, over time, any fuel that was used in that, any damage that those trucks do, very quickly is rewarded with the good things that come out of it.
Yeah. I imagine it's not just a question of let's move a whole bunch of dirt. This is a pretty complex project, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. There's all kinds of engineering. There's all kinds of, they have to widen some bridges that are going over these narrow bits of water now. But now if we're going to spread it out, they need to make the bridge span a larger area. So that's been, they did one at Quartz Creek. It's going to be the same way at this new one I was talking about. And So there's major bits of construction. There's a whole lot of engineering, a whole lot of, on the ground once you're there saying, this spot, let's leave this because there's this great, thriving little ecosystem here or a beaver that you don't want to move.
Did the fire in some ways make it easier for them to sort of do this project? Just because obviously a lot of trees got burned and out of the way. I don't know if that created a bit of a pathway for them.
Well, pathway maybe, but what it also did is they're using a whole lot of logs to make these log jams that will help the water find these crevices and pools. And so they needed a whole bunch of material and, for good or bad, the fires gave them so much material. So even a burned log is fine, and it leaves that carbon in the system. It was material they were going to need to source from somewhere. And so the fire provided thousands of logs that are going to be used in these projects.
Wow. Karen, my last question for you is, I don't know if you had you got an idea from talking to the people that were there that are doing this project. 5-10 years down the road, if we're driving up 126, how different is it going to look?
Right. I think from 126, it might not look so different. Mm-hmm. But if you took a couple of these side roads up to some of the creeks that they have been working on, and check out one today on your way to Cougar Reservoir and see what it looks like now, and then see what it looks like in 5 years. And it's going to be very different. It'll be a wetlands with the one we went to at Fin Rock Reach. We had to walk quite a ways in to get sort of an island in the middle of the whole area. But there are now willows that are just towering tall after 3 years.
Wow.
And all kinds of evidence of other change.
Interesting. Well, that's fascinating. Karen Richards, reporter for us here at KLCC. Thanks so much.
Absolutely.
That's the show for today. All episodes of Oregon on the Record are available as a podcast at klcc.org. Tomorrow on the show, we'll learn about new ways to help veterans dealing with PTSD. I'm Michael Dunn, host of Oregon on the Record. Thanks for listening.